Welcome to Necessary Conversations with Daryl M. Taliaferro. Conversations that are real, raw, and relevant. Let's get the conversation started now.
Hey, welcome to episode number 6 of Necessary Conversations. On today's episode, we're going to converse about the injustice of the justice system. And here to help me do that is my guest, attorney Keita Haynes. Now, Keita is the senior legal advisor at Free Hearts, a nonprofit organization led by formerly incarcerated women. There they provide support, education, advocacy for families impacted by incarceration and deportation. Now, prior to her employment at Free Hearts, Keita served as assistant public defender, where she devoted all of her professional energies and passions representing those charged with crimes. You see, Keita is not your average attorney. No. Keita brings a unique perspective to criminal defense and the justice system, as she herself spent almost 4 years in federal prison known as inmate 00017-011, simply for her alleged involvement in a drug distribution ring. Keita Haynes, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing well, thank you.
If you've watched the news over the last few years, months, weeks, days, hours, or even minutes, then you're clearly aware that the justice system is broken. You see, we've seen the innocent locked up and the guilty go free. We live in a country where the edict has been, you're innocent until proven guilty, but we all know, based upon the injustice of the justice system, that you're guilty until proven innocent. On today's episode, I want to take a journey. Let's take a trip. Let's hear the story of one who was affected by this injustice and how this injustice reignited a fire within her to fight for the justice for one and for all. Keita, take us back to when it all happened.
Okay, so when I was in college at Tennessee State University, I think I was like 19 years old, I met a guy who, my sister and I had went out for her 21st birthday, and I met a guy when we were leaving the club. And we talked for a month or so. He lived in Memphis and said that he was here doing an internship. We'd lost contact for a while, and then maybe like about a year or so later, he called me again and said that he had lost my number, but wanted to reestablish contact with me. He had found the number. And so, of course, finding out none of that was really true. But so we started a long distance relationship because he was still in Memphis and I was here in Nashville. And a few months into the relationship, he asked me if I would accept packages for a business that him and his cousins had. He said that they had a Beepers Plus shop here in Nashville and one in Memphis, and that no one would be at the shop here in Nashville when FedEx would deliver the packages. Mm-hmm. And he explained that they had had problems with people taking the packages before when FedEx would just leave the packages there. And so they wanted to make sure that someone was able to get the packages. And he said that they would, you know, send the packages either to my job where I was working at, which was in the mall, or either to my house so that it wouldn't be an inconvenience for me. And his cousins would just pick the packages up for me so that way they can make sure they were secure.
Right.
So I agreed to accept the packages. They sent packages to me. And they also sent packages to one of my friends and to my sister when I was no longer able to accept the packages because I got a different job. And turns out none of these packages contained cell phones and pagers, but they contained marijuana.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So they got you out here collecting drugs.
So that, yes, essentially they had me signing my name for drugs, mm-hmm, for marijuana. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So how did it all hit the fan?
So what happened was there were two separate incidents. There was a situation with one of my friends. He knew that she was having some financial issues and had just had a baby and, you know, and also had some issues with her mom who she was living with. And so he told her, he was just like, well, why don't you accept the packages? You know, we'll pay you the $50. You'll have money, you know, since you're not working, you know, you've got the baby, whatever, whatever. So she said that she would, and when the package was sent to her, she wasn't at home, and her mom opened the package and saw that it was marijuana in the package. Mm. And so she was arrested along with a guy from Memphis. And so, of course, the guy that I was dating said that he knew nothing about this, that it was his cousins out in California that had sent this package, and they had never sent me marijuana. They had always sent me cell phones and pagers. They knew what I was in school, you know, at the time, majoring in criminal justice and psychology. They would never put me in a situation that would impact that, all of these types of things. And so she ended up getting like a state charge or something. And then like a few months later, when my sister had started accepting the packages, my sister went to pick up a package, and she went to pick it up from the FedEx in Williamson County. And it was essentially what they call kind of like a reverse sting operation, where they let her pick up the package. And when she signed for it and went to put it in a car, she said when she went to shut the trunk, there were like, you know, police officers and everybody like around her with guns pointing like all at her.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That had to scare her like crazy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, she had no idea like what was happening and why all of these police officers were around her, you know, with guns pointing at her, telling her, you know, not to move and, you know, and to step away from her car and all of these other types of things. Yeah. So that started the whole thing in the federal system. So they ended up indicting 29 of us, myself included, not my sister. My sister's was a state charge as well, too. But they ended up indicting 29 of us in federal court, and everybody pled guilty except for me. I was the only person that went to trial.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So even the young lady who was pregnant and had children and her mother found it first, she pled guilty?
She had a state charge, and I am really not sure exactly what happened with her case. Okay. I'm not really sure if she really knew what happened with her case, which speaks to a larger issue of people not knowing what's happening with their cases and what they're pleading to, you know, in the criminal justice system. They're just doing things to get it over with and, you know, and to be able to move on with their lives.
Right. Not realizing that whatever they sign or whatever they decide has an effect on their lives long term.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Wow. So you're the outlier. You're the oxymoron. You're the person that says, no, I'm about to go against the grain, and I'm not pleading guilty to something that I legit didn't do.
Right. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right, so when this happens, obviously, I'm confident that individuals probably try to convince you, just go ahead and plead guilty. You'll get a lesser sentence or whatever, but you still say no.
The only people that tried to convince me to do a plea was the U.S. attorney.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even them trying to convince me. They were threatening me. You know, they were saying that they were going to give me 20 years, 10 years. They were going to take my car, you know, all kinds of things. I mean, like, there was so much intimidation and so much bullying in this process that I don't even think people are aware of when it comes to the criminal justice system. You would have thought that I was moving keys of cocaine from Mexico up to the United States or something, living in a lavish life. And here I am, you know, somebody from Franklin, never been in any type of trouble before, believed this guy that I was dating that I loved, that he was sending me cell phones and pages, and turns out it was marijuana. The way that they were pursuing me, you would have thought that I was
moving some weight.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
So the good thing is that I had a really good attorney who had told me that, you know, he's not afraid to go to trial. He goes to trial all the time. And if that's what I wanted to do, then that's what we would prepare to do. But being a lawyer, anytime the U.S. attorney, the state, whoever the prosecutor makes an offer to your clients, you have an ethical obligation to convey that offer to your clients. So he would bring me the offers here and there. But I mean, there was no way that I was ever going to plead to anything, because I just did not believe that people that were not guilty should be pleading to things that they didn't do. And, right. You know, and that's what I believed in. And that's what I chose to stand on.
Yeah. So you get to court, you have this trial.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have this trial, it's going well, I'm assuming, or does it not go so well? What happens?
So the trial was interesting. The trial lasted an entire week. And the issue at trial was whether I knew what was in the boxes or not. That was the only issue at trial. You know, and that was the only issue concerning me. I think that they had proved that there was a conspiracy as far as everyone else was concerned. But, you know, that had nothing to do with me. It really centered around my knowledge and what I knew and when I knew it. And right. So they brought in all of these people to testify against me. I had no idea who most of them were. Still wouldn't know who they were if they knocked on my door today.
Yeah.
And the guy that I had dated at the time, they had him testify as well, too. And he even told them that he never told me what was in the boxes, that he lied to me the entire time about what was in the packages. And there's this thing that they call a deliberate ignorance instruction. And so basically they can say, well, you may not have known, but you should have known.
Really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so... you know, we argued against them being able to use that,
right.
But the judge allowed the government to go ahead and to be able to use that jury instruction. And so that was what they convicted me of. Not that I had proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which right. is the standard, but, you know, they felt like that I should have known what was in these boxes, even though nobody testified that they told me what was in the boxes. And as a matter of fact, the guy that I was dating came to court and told them that he never told me what was in the boxes, that he lied to me and lied to everybody, you know, the entire time about what was in the boxes. Like right. that was the cover story.
Wow. So you're convicted of this crime, and this is a federal charge,
mm-hmm.
which ultimately placed a felony on your record.
Mm-hmm.
Now you get sentenced and you get shipped off to jail.
Yes, kind of.
All right. Tell us about that then.
Okay. So it wasn't exactly like that. You know, I thank God that it wasn't like that. It, you know, definitely is like that for a lot of people. So yeah. What happened was, is that I actually had 7 charges and I was acquitted of 6 charges and was only found guilty of aiding and abetting a conspiracy to distribute 100 to 400 kilograms of marijuana.
Wow.
Now, that 100 to 400 kilograms of marijuana carries a mandatory minimum sentence in the federal system of 5 years. Mm-hmm. So I was looking at no less than 5 years in federal prison off top, regardless, even though I had no criminal history, had never been involved in the criminal justice system, was in college, majoring in criminal justice, you know, all of that. I was right. looking at 5 years off top because of the mandatory minimum sentence and laws at the time. There was nothing that could have been done essentially at that time. So at the sentencing, what happened was that the judge told me that I was lucky to have been acquitted of all of the other charges and that any person of my intelligence should have known that I was dealing with something highly illegal. And she sentenced me, again, someone who had never had any exposure to the criminal justice system, to 7 years in federal prison, which was an additional 2 years above the federal mandatory minimum sentencing that I was already facing. So, yeah, so that was in September of that year. I was in my last semester of school at TSU. And so she did allow me to stay out to finish. And, you know, we were in the process of appealing a lot of things. And so I didn't find out that I was going to have to report to Alderson Federal Prison Camp to start serving these 7 years until 2 weeks before I had to report. So essentially, you know, about 2 or 3 weeks after I graduated with my degree, I had to report to Alderson Federal Prison Camp to start serving this 7-year sentence.
Wow. So how much of this sentence did you actually serve?
So we appealed the case all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court granted the appeal, sent it back, and I was resentenced. And the judge resentenced me to the mandatory minimum of 5 years then. And she told me at that time I had been in prison for probably about like 18 months or so. And she told me that I had gotten everything that I would ever get from prison, but because of the federal mandatory minimum sentencing laws, she had no choice but to send me back. So she resentenced me to the 5 years, which is 60 months, and I went back to prison. And there's no parole or anything in the federal system, so you do 85% of your time. So 85% of 60 months is 3 years and 10 months, almost 4 years on that 5-year sentence.
Wow. So you have 85% of the sentence that you do, and unfortunately, this is time away from your actual life,
mm-hmm.
based upon something that you legitimately did not know, that you were not directly involved in, but because of a favor, you're now implicated and caught up in this whole conspiracy. So as you're in prison, you know, I dare to say prior to prison, you're on this trajectory because you're taking criminal justice at TSU as an undergrad student. So you're already on a path toward helping individuals who are disproportionately affected, you know, by the injustice system, as I keep calling it. But then you say, I'm really going to obviously pursue this now because now it's affected me. What prompted the urgency now at this point of helping people?
Well, I was actually planning on going to law school before I even went to prison. It was something that, you know, that I had thought about and you talked to one of my professors at TSU about and really decided that that was what I was going to do. Actually, I had a job working with an attorney that was supposed to start the very same day that I was supposed to report to prison. And so I had to call him and tell him that I couldn't take the job because I had to go to federal prison. So it was already something that I was going to do. But then, you know, when you get to prison, because I had already studied a lot about the federal mandatory minimum sentencing laws at this time, we still had in place the 100 to 1 crack cocaine, powder cocaine ratio, which we all know, just disproportionately impacted Black and brown and low income communities. And had done a lot of research on that, majoring in criminal justice. And so already kind of, you know, knew some things about that. But when I got to prison and, you know, and I'm seeing, you know, the women and I'm hearing them talk about, you know, their stories and what happened to them. And there are women there that do have 10 years, that have 20 years, that have 30 years, all because of drugs, all because of this fictitious war on drugs. And I am literally seeing like the numbers that I had looked at and had researched, like they literally came to life, like right in front of me. And, you know, when you see this, you know, it's just like, the numbers that you looked at, you know, all of these things, like these are people, like these are mothers, you know, these are daughters, these are sisters, you know, and, you know, these are wives and, you know, and they have lives and these are stories. And, you know, and so I was so moved and so compelled just to want to do something, you know, even more about the system at that point. And then just being there and just hearing the women, you know, talk about their situation and their stories. You know, a lot of them didn't have the money to be able to afford a private attorney. So they had public defenders and, you know, they didn't have the best experience with their public defenders. And so it was in prison that I decided that I wanted to be a public defender because, you know, I was blessed to be able to afford to have a private attorney and knowing the level of representation that I got from him and then hearing the stories from the women about, you know, the things that they felt that their attorneys did not do. I said I wanted to be able to give the level of representation that I had from my attorney to people who could not afford to pay for it. And so that's where I decided that I, you know, because I always like went into it, you know, knowing that I wanted to be a criminal defense lawyer. And, you know, and just felt like with having the attorney that I had was able to glean from him. But it was in prison where I was just like, no, I'm going to be a public defender. Like I'm going to serve, you know, people that, you know, communities and society feels, you know, that they're the least of these in the community. You know, and I mean, and I knew what it was like to be considered, you know, the least of those because I was, you know, someone that they considered the least of those as well too at that moment. And, you know, and so I just felt, you know, just really compelled to do what I could do when it came to that, do what I could do as far as dismantling, you know, systemic racism in the criminal justice system, you know, do what I could do, you know, when it comes to, you know, talking about, you know, the federal mandatory minimum sentencing laws and letting people know, you know, how it, you know, essentially did decimate Black and brown and low income communities and how, you know, they need to be repealed. And so it was in prison, like seeing all of these things and literally, you know, essentially being, you know, also these things too, that, you know, it was just like, you know what, I've got to do something about this. Like I cannot see these things and then be silent about them.
Yeah. So for you, this was more than just a job. This was now a calling because this was a call to act immediately.
Yes.
Yeah, that's good. You know, one of the things that is impressive is how you were not turned off by the justice system, but you were essentially turned on, because situations like this can make you say, nah, I'm not getting involved in a broken system, or I'm not getting involved in this system that really doesn't care for Black and brown individuals. But no, you said, no, I'm going to get involved because I can be the change that I want to see.
Mm-hmm. You know, I believe that those of us that are closest to the problem are closest to the solution. And without having the voices of people that have been formerly incarcerated, people that have been directly impacted by the criminal justice system, without those voices, it's nothing but numbers. Yeah. And the voices and the stories, it's what makes it real to people, you know, when we're talking about this. And the thing is that, you know, those of us that have been impacted, we have a unique perspective about what needs to be changed when it comes to the criminal justice system. And, you know, and it's so interesting, you just with, you know, with talking with people, particularly, you know, like when I ran for office and just talking about various barriers to reentry that people face that have been formerly incarcerated. And a lot of this is not even stuff that people even recognize. Like, people don't understand that people that have been formerly incarcerated, you know, or have felonies on their record, have a hard time getting life insurance. People don't understand that. You know, people don't understand, like, in the midst of the pandemic, at the height of it, when the federal government, you know, was trying to help and they were giving out the PPP loans, that there was, you know, a provision in there that prevented people that had felonies on their record from being able to take advantage of that. Wow. And the thing is that I know and know several people that have been formerly incarcerated that have come out and they have their own businesses, and they also employ other people that have been formerly incarcerated, and their businesses took hits like everybody else, but they were not able to take advantage of this government program because of this one provision that was included in there. And so that's why I always says that it's important, because while there are well-meaning people out there that want to be involved in criminal justice reform, if you haven't experienced it, you can't view it from that lens. Yeah. And so there are things, while you may have good intentions, there are things that you may not know and that you may not see. And you may be crafting laws and policies that you think that are going to be beneficial to people that have been formerly incarcerated. But when actually, and you know, when you look at it and start looking at the long-term effect of these things, it's really not. And so, again, for me, it was just like, I have to act. And I get that there were so many women that I was in prison that have went on with their lives because they just wanted to forget about it and move on. And, you know, and I don't judge people for that either. You know, we all deal with it in whatever ways, you know, we choose to deal with it. But I just felt like that it was an opportunity for me to really have conversations about who we are as people that are formerly incarcerated. So really just to take a negative situation and, you know, and turn it into something that I could use it, not just to benefit me, but to benefit so many others, you know, before me. And that's, you know, that would come behind me.
Yeah. So when you consider individuals who have felonies on their record, you know, I know a few people as well who have felonies that are incredibly successful.
Mm-hmm.
You can never judge a book by its cover, you know?
Right.
I guarantee you, those of you who are listening to this podcast, if you were to see Attorney Keita Haynes walk down the street, you would never in a million years guess that she has been given the label of a felon. There are other individuals that I know who've also been given that label that you will never know. To that point, though, it's unfortunate to know that the basic necessities of human life, such as life insurance,
mm-hmm.
is prohibitive based upon a felony.
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost like you have to ask the question, what are they going to do? Like, why are you prohibiting me from having life insurance and I just have a felony?
Well, because they say that because of the lifestyle that you live or lived, that, you know what I'm saying, that resulted in you getting this felony conviction would cause you to be more of a risk or a danger when it comes to insuring you because of this lifestyle that, you know, that you lived or that they assumed that you lived, even, you know, when it's been years ago.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's something that I believe that when you talk about those who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution, I believe that in situations such as that, there ought to be someone who is a felon or someone who has experienced the challenges of the justice system to be on every decision-making board, because ultimately they can add a perspective that those who have not been affected by the justice system, as you said earlier, simply cannot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and these issues are not just issues of, well, perhaps they may be a need. No, life insurance is an actual need, because it not only affects the person, it affects the descendants of the person, you know, mm-hmm. your children, your children's children. You know, mm-hmm. when you really think about the wealth in this world, many people, many families, when you talk about generational wealth is started by life insurance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have million and $2 million and $3 million policies that obviously as the policy holder, you won't see this, but your children will see this, mm-hmm. or your children's children will see this. And then endowments and trust begin to, you know, occur in the world because of this one decision. And now mm-hmm. you have a company saying, because of your past, mm-hmm. we're not going to give this to you.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it happens with, you know, with life insurance, it happens with jobs, you know, it happens with education, it happens in housing, you know, it happens pretty much in every single area that you can really think about. And so that's why, you know, when I talk about, you know, reentry a lot, because it's, you know, something that's, you know, really, you know, near and dear to me. I always tell people that before we can have conversations about whether people that have been formerly incarcerated, you know, are successful, we have to have the conversation first about whether they can be successful.
Yeah.
You know, because there are so many barriers to reentry that people face that the average person doesn't understand. And so it's just so easy for us to say, oh, well, you know, well, you know, they should come out and, you know what I'm saying, and they could, you know, make a successful transition back into the community. But when there are so many barriers, when there are so many things that are stacked against them, even when we first even just talk about the language, because language matters. And yeah. we can't say that, you know, we are wanting people to be successful, but still we're labeling them and we're calling them an ex-felon. We're calling them an ex-convict. You know, we are labeling them and we are relegating them to live as second-class citizens. Mm-hmm. And so we have to really look at that and we have to say, are we really a second-chance city? You know, do we really provide people that have been formerly incarcerated the opportunity that they need in order to make a successful transition back into the community? And I think, you know, we have to look at ourselves in the mirror and we have to ask ourselves the hard questions and then be willing to put in the necessary work in order to allow people to make successful transitions back in the community. And I think first and foremost, it starts with language. People that have been formerly incarcerated, we're mothers, we're fathers, you know, we're, you know, daughters, we're brothers, we're sisters, we're humans, and we deserve to be humanized and we deserve to be treated as such. And we don't deserve to be treated, you know, we're all more than the worst thing that we have ever done or the worst thing that we have all been accused of doing. Mm-hmm. And I think that when it comes to people that have been formerly incarcerated, I think that, you know, we need to learn to extend that very same grace to them that is extended to each and every single one of us, each and every single day of our lives.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Join us next week for episode number 7. This will be part 2 of the conversation with Keita Haynes, The Injustice of the Justice System. You don't want to miss it.
Thanks for listening to Necessary Conversations with Daryl M. Taliaferro. Follow us on social media at Necessary Conversations Podcast. Join the conversation by leaving a message on our website, necessaryconversationspodcast.com. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast so you'll be notified every time a new one drops. Now, go have the conversations you need to have with the people you need to have them with.